8:50 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
I'm sorry, it's a little loud in here. I didn't quite catch your name.
Mary. Well, my name is Maria, but they call me Mary.
Il perché?
Non so.
That's right. You're a singer too. I forgot Tony had mentioned it. How come I haven't seen you around?
I'm from Brooklyn, so I mostly perform around there.
Ladies and gentlemen, benvenuti! Come stiamo?
What's going on?
Watch this.
Oh, no, that's not gonna cut it for Friday night. Come stiamo? Yeah, see, that's a little better. How about we start this evening off right? Maestro, maybe we give them La Canzone della Gaza.
Ah, sì, la serenata!
Yeah, maestro! If you know it, join in. If you don't, sing it anyway. Oh, la serenata, la mia diletta è sola. E con la vela testa abbandonata, posata la lenzuola.
And you have just heard a brief little excerpt, and I think it will be a tantalizing excerpt from an 8-part series that is being shared with the public right now from Brew City Opera. It's a program or series called L'Ultima Canzone, and it features the music of the great composer Paolo Tosti, responsible for some of the most popular and beloved Italian songs ever composed, and some very, very talented people from southeastern Wisconsin are collaborating on this project. And I'm really excited to be able to speak in this portion of the morning show with Edson Melendez, who is general director of Brew City Opera. We'll find out briefly from him what and who Brew City Opera is, and then a little bit more about this really neat series called L'Ultima Canzone. Edson Melendez, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Thank you for having us on. We're so thrilled to be here.
Glad that you can be part of this. I know that right off the bat, we should acknowledge something, because I know it's one reason why you put together this wonderful series and some of the other things that Brew City Opera has been doing, but that this COVID-19 pandemic has been a brutal time for just about everybody involved in any aspect of the performing arts. So, just say a quick word about what the last 13 months or so have been like for you and so many of your colleagues and friends.
Well, as you can imagine, it's been, and you know firsthand, it's been extremely difficult. And everybody right now is sort of trying to think outside of the box. We're trying to figure out what we can do to support our individual companies, our partners and friends in other companies, and what type of project we could do to keep the arts not only alive, but relevant through this time. And so a lot of people have gone to either digital, visual formats, a lot of virtual formats, and we've decided to go with an audio format.
Tell us, before we talk about L'Ultima Canzone, which is the 8-part series we'll really dig into in the excerpt from which we just played, a little bit about the creation of Brew City Opera itself.
Sure. So Brew City Opera came about, the general conversation around it came about maybe in 2017 between the artistic director, Tim Reavers, and I, and me. And we, you know, we're good friends and kind of opera nerds. And he had composed a number of things. He had rearranged a number of things. At that point, I had been stage directing more than singing. And we had an idea for a Carmen. And we thought, man, this is a great idea. How are we going to do this? You know, who's going to produce this for us? And the answer wasn't there for us. So I said, well, let's do it amongst ourselves. Let's call in our friends that we know are great performers who are performing all over the country, actually. And let's figure out how to do it. And what's the medium going to be, you know, in terms of companies? I said, we're going to start our own. And everybody said, you are insane. But that's the genesis of Bruce City Opera. And our first production was actually Carmen, which is an incredibly ambitious endeavor. Mm.
So in other words, this is a little bit like when Halle Berry starts her own production company in order to generate material either that she wants to do or that others might do, but that she wants to see happen, see come to fruition, that if you don't see the world of Hollywood generating the kind of material that you think deserves airing, you create your own company and you make it happen in a sense yourself instead of waiting for somebody else to make it happen. It sounds like not quite that grandiose a scale, although anything involved in opera is going to be grandiose to an extent, but it sounds like that is part of what was generating this idea.
Sure, that's that was part of it. The other thing is that we wanted to make productions that were accessible to people who thought or think that opera is only for those who can afford $200 tickets and have to wear mink coats and stuff, because that's not the reality of opera at all. We have a couple of great companies in Milwaukee, and we wanted to, you know, hopefully get people interested in opera so that they ultimately end up going to see our friends at Milwaukee Opera Theater and, of course, Florentine Opera, which is a phenomenal organization that both Tim and I have relationships with. You know, and hopefully grow the fan base of what I consider just the most impactful art form in the world.
So bringing opera down to a more intimate level and more intimate spaces, and also where you are reaching people, where it isn't going to be quite so expensive a ticket or quite so intimidating a setting. There are a lot of good reasons to do what you're doing. So I absolutely applaud you. So tell us a little bit about what Bruce City Opera has tried to do during this pandemic and how those efforts and discussions have ultimately led to L'Ultima Canzone.
So we, at the beginning of all of this, like I think all of, you know, the world thought this would be pretty short-lived. So we should, you know, just put our projects on hold. And then we quickly realized that this is not going to be so short-lived. So we started busting our heads and we came across idea after idea that were just not feasible, didn't make a whole lot of sense. We want to make sure that we're being good stewards of the community, that we are not perpetuating the idea that it's okay to get together and do this as much as we want to and as painful as it was to not be able to do it. But it was an irresponsible thing to do. So we then thought, well, what is it that we can do? And this idea of L'Ultima Canzone came about a long time ago, spawning from my very unhealthy obsession with these Tosi songs. And so we thought, well, what if we work on this show? And Tim said, what if we make it a podcast or, you know, just like a radio drama? And I thought, that's great. And then we had more conversation and we decided, except for true aficionados, nobody's really going to sit around listening to a 90-minute show that they've never heard of, you know. And so Tim said, well, let's do it in episodes so that they're digestible and they, you know, people can tune in for 10 to 15 minutes and it's not intimidating and you don't need a whole evening to sit down and listen to this, because it's really hard to sit down and listen to something without visuals anyway, especially these days where attention span is not what it once was for this type of you know, art. So that's how we ended up with where we did this show and how COVID actually helped us develop it.
Tell our listeners a little bit more about this name, Tosti. Let's spell that name for everybody, T-O-S-T-I, Paolo Tosti. First of all, what was your introduction to him and to his wonderful songs?
I heard somebody sing the song that actually opens the show, Tormento, at a graduate recital when I was at Arizona State. This was a doctoral student. And I heard it and I thought, what the heck is that? That's amazing. And so I immediately went to the library and pulled everything that had the name Tosti on it and just fell in love with the melodies, with the text. Anybody who knows me already knows that I'm an Italophile. And, you know, when I started doing more research on him, I heard that he was, you know, really, or I found out that he was really good friends with Puccini. And he was highly recommended by Verdi and Ennio Roncavallo and all these great opera composers. And, you know, that just got me more and more interested in his music. And ultimately, you know, the quote that really got me was that Puccini said that he was the epitome of Italian musical sentiment, which I already knew from listening. But that was a quote that he had. And he also had an extremely fascinating life, basically beginning at nothing and ended up being knighted by the Queen of England and being the personal musical tutor to Princess Beatrice. And it's just incredible how his life developed and how his art developed.
So explain this storyline that we follow through the course of these 8 episodes. And kind of the nature of how that took shape.
Well, you know, the storyline is really not that different than most operas that, you know, revolve around love and things of that nature. Some have said it's a little stereotypical, and it is, but we kind of wanted that because we wanted it to feel familiar. You know, for me, a lot of the excitement is, we know where we're going to end up. How do we end up there? What happens in the middle of ending up there? So that's something that is really, really interesting to me. So what we did is we took 18 of these Tosti songs and we built a narrative around them. And it begins with a melancholic lounge performer in 1950s Little Italy who has had his heart broken and finds out that his former love was to be wedded the next day. His best friend comes and drags him out to the club where they, you know, where they work and where they do all sorts of other things, and you know, convinces him to go and have a night out and be his wingman, basically. Well, while being his wingman, he meets Mary, and they strike a wonderful conversation. They have a lot in common. Things progress and, you know, they become a couple. Right as they're at the height of their love, the ex-lover, Nina, comes back into his life, saying that she's made a mistake, she's leaving her husband, that she wants to get back together with him. And, you know, at one point grabs him, kisses him, and that is what Mary sees and nothing else. And so they split, he tells Nina to go away. He's once again melancholic and sad and basically on the verge of doing some real harm to himself. His best friend convinces Mary to go see him and, you know, they reconcile their love. And that's where the show ends. So in a way, it's a very familiar story. But the path that they take and, you know, the music that dictates it is really quite exciting.
So tell us about the construction of this and the recording of this. I'm really quite impressed by the high standard of what we hear. How did this actually take shape?
So these pieces were conceived as recital pieces. They are not meant to be, you know, dramatic pieces that move forward. They're meant to stand alone, tell their individual stories. So a lot of what we had to do was sort of recontextualize them and put them in a dramatic purpose so that they served as the quote unquote arias in the show. You know, the way a song would serve in a musical, you know, by Rodgers and Hammerstein or something like that. So we tried, we did actually remain very, very true to the words and music of Tolstoy. In some cases, what we had to do was, you know, snip a line here or there and things of that nature. But we remained very true and we recontextualized the songs to fit the narrative. After that, you know, we wanted a little bit different of a landscape or soundscape for these songs. So Tim rearranged the songs that were traditionally just for piano, and he rearranged them for violin, guitar, and piano. And that gave us a little bit fuller orchestration. It gave us a more expressive quality with the violin. And because all of the characters are sort of 1950s Italian club singers, it gave us that image of walking into those, you know, red and white checkered Italian restaurants with opera playing in the background and the violinist strolling around. And that's how we ended up there. The actual recording process was thankfully in a very, very large space. And it was happening just as people were getting vaccinated and things were a little bit safer according to the CDC. So what we did is that we were all in the same room at different times. As much as we could record in chunks, limiting the number of people is what we did. So we recorded, you know, anything that was a solo aria, we recorded with the ensemble and that singer. And anything that was a duet, you know, we recorded with the ensemble and those two people. So that's kind of how we ended up recording it. And we were in a very, very large space and we were very spread out. Everybody was individually mic'd. And then our recording engineer, Andrew, really put it all together for us. And he's a former singer. He knows music, he knows classical music, but his background is also in recording. And he just did an amazing job to capture the soundscape that we wanted.
Right. It's great. Who's responsible for the script?
I am.
Open script.
I am responsible for.
And I feel like you've done a really great job of creating distinctive characters, and I have to say your cast really does a great job as well of bringing these different characters to life. Were you also in a sense the stage director for this?
I was a stage director, so the concept and the direction is mine. And of course, nobody does that stuff alone. You know, it helps when you have a cast of incredible performers the way we did. Tim Reavers, you know, Southeastern Wisconsin, one of the most important operatic figures. Andrew Varela, who's been on Broadway. We have Kristen Danino, who has been at, I don't know, 20 different opera companies, 10 to 20 different opera companies around the country. She was a Florentine young artist for a couple of years, which is how I met her. And she's returned to Milwaukee. And Sarah Frank, who is just an incredible performer herself, is well known around the country and also one of the directors at Opera for the Young. So, you know, it's just an incredible cast. And then our spoken role is Bob Balderson, who is a Milwaukee actor, who is just phenomenal, nicest guy ever, and an incredible actor and supporter of the arts.
And I suppose one of the silver linings of this awful pandemic when it comes to a project like this is that, at least for the most part, you have people eager / desperate for any opportunity to do what they love to do. I mean, with so many of the performing arts either stopped dead in their tracks or sharply restricted, when an opportunity like this comes along, I should think it doesn't take a lot of persuading to get a lot of talented people on board.
No, it really doesn't. And a lot of them were on board when this concept first came to life about, you know, 5 years ago or so. But availability was the issue. You know, they were busy performing artists that had other jobs. And, you know, it was really hard to get everybody together to do something like this. And like you say, a silver lining was that everybody was around and they weren't doing a whole lot of other things. And as soon as I contacted, each and every one of them said, yep, I'm on board. They didn't even have to know that much about it. They just said, you know, you're involved, Tim's involved, I'm on board.
Well, it's really a great project. I've enjoyed what I've heard thus far and look forward to hearing more of it. So explain to our listeners as we are speaking, as they are hearing this, I should say, on Friday the 7th of May, what already has been shared with the public of L'Ultima Canzone? What remains?
So episode one went out live on our YouTube channel. You can also see it on our website and follow us on Facebook, and we have links to all of that. Episode one went out Tuesday night, so the 4th, at 8 p.m. And every Tuesday at 8 p.m. for the following 7 weeks, we'll release another episode. They're all 10 to 15 minute episodes, so they're easily digestible. And if you have 10 minutes here, you have 10 minutes there, jump on. It doesn't need to be the day of. They live on Facebook after we release them. So if you have a little bit more time on the weekends and couldn't make the Tuesday night, go ahead, pop it up, and do some dishes while we yell at you in the background.
I think that, first of all, the overall concept is great, and the idea of breaking it into episodes to be a little more easily and conveniently digested is really, really brilliant, and it's also executed very, very nicely. And it is free of charge for people to enjoy, although, of course, you're hoping that a number of people will express their appreciation for what you've put together with some donations, and I know you give information for that at the end of each episode. So what about...
Another thing to notice is that these are all local performers, and one of the missions of Bruce City Opera is to support artists in all forms. It's been tough on our performing friends, and we want to make sure that we are supporting them the best we can.
As for the future, as this pandemic moves into kind of a new phase, of course, and little by little, what seems a little more like normalcy starts to return, what are your hopes and dreams for Bruce City Opera for the future?
Well, we hope to return to live performances. One of the things we'd like to focus on is doing productions that can actually move. We have all these great old, opera/vaudeville houses around the state, and we would like to bring those performances there because the houses are not being used for what they were built for. And those communities are not getting a lot of exposure to the operatic art form. So we hope to do that, but mostly just be here at home, support our local artists in Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin, and return to live productions.
Well, that's everybody's hope and dream. And we hope that Bruce City Opera can be right in the mix of it with more innovative productions. So we want to remind everybody once again of L'Ultima Canzone, an 8-part series that is being shared with the public via a number of different mechanisms, including Facebook and, did you say YouTube also?
Yeah, we have a YouTube channel.
Right. And so the first episode has been shared and is still available. And each Tuesday evening at 8 p.m., was it, I think?
That's true. Yep.
Next episode will be aired, 8 of them in all. And some very, very talented singers and actors from southeastern Wisconsin, and the beautiful songs of Paolo Tosti woven into the fabric of L'Ultima Canzone. And the concept is that of general director of the Bruce City Opera, Edson Melendez. Edson Melendez, great to catch up with you again, and best wishes to you and everybody involved with L'Ultima Canzone.
Great to hear you again, Greg. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two.
Thank you. This is the Cinderella Waltz of Richard Rodgers, and it, of course, comes from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Enchanting Cinderella, a work which they composed for CBS television and which was first seen live over the air with a young Julie Andrews in the title role. This work has gone on to become one of their most beloved works, and it is being performed this weekend at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, with a special matinee a little later this morning, and then public performances live streamed tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday as well. In part two of today's morning show, I'm speaking with Rachel Swartz, who is the new coordinator of musical theater at the University of Wisconsin Parkside and director of this production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. I first asked her about what a challenging year this has been for her and her colleagues, her counterparts at other schools. This COVID-19 pandemic has been a devastating blow for the performing arts community, but also a wonderful opportunity for innovation. And certainly UW Parkside has done more than its fair share of innovating in trying to bring performing arts to the public, even under very trying circumstances.
This is our fifth successful show of the season that we've been able to produce because the safety protocols have been so stringent. We've been able to make art in spite of incredible complexities. We have a six-camera multicam setup, so it will be live-streamed rather than pre-filmed and edited. But all of the, it's switching camera to camera, so that way audiences can get the closest and most personal sensibility. And while I'm sitting in the theater and watching through the camera monitors, as well as being able to peek around my monitor and watch the folks on stage, sometimes it feels... It feels for a proscenium musical we're sitting in a big, 600 seat house. I get to get as close as we would in a small intimate black box space to these actors and these stories. And it's really exciting to be able to tell narratives in that way.
Interesting.
So it has been a wild ride for creating art and teaching classes and, teaching acting classes while in masks and all of those wonderful things. And of course, I can't wait until we're all healthy and safely sharing space together. But I'm thrilled that we're able to live stream this project and do so for free. So that way we can share art with you all right now safely, as well as it's lovely to see for a lot of our students whose families are not in the area that they're able to join us and witness what their young folks are creating. So that is a wonderful byproduct of being able to share this digitally.
Hmm. How big a difference has it made in terms of you as the director of this production to be directing it in this way or in this format versus directing the show to be on the stage in front of an audience that's right there in the theater, in the auditorium? What kind of difference does that make for you in terms of the choices that you make, particularly in terms of where your actors go, where they walk, where they stand, how they sing, how they emote, or by and large, is it largely the same performance that it would otherwise be, but just being presented or shared in a different way?
Oh, I completely altered the way I direct in order to complete this project. From day one, we knew where our cameras would be placed. So each and every scene, my cast knows, we've numbered the cameras 1 through 6. As I'm staging a scene, I'm saying, hey, Cinderella, keep in mind, we need to, for this moment, yes, you're playing this scene between you and, this other character, but this moment when you're alone on stage, we get to speak directly to camera, and that's going to be camera 2, so make sure we take in exactly where that is. So that has been incredibly different. I think one of my favorite parts is something that I'm being utterly spoiled by, and when I have to go back to producing live and in person, my goodness, camera misdirection makes scene shifts easier. So it is quite simple to bring in big scenery pieces or change costumes or do other exciting things when I just make one camera look a little bit right or left. And simply sneak something in. While it would be completely visible and is completely visible while standing in the house, it allows a show that calls for magic to be just a little bit more magical. So that has been a fun and exciting thing to solve.
What about for your students? What is your sense of how different this feels versus what a production from a year and a half ago felt like? Or for them, is it largely the same experience? Are you trying to make it for them as artists a very similar experience to what it would otherwise have been?
So ironically, my other position to create, my other task of creating coursework at UW Parkside is I am the professor of acting for the camera. So, and have done quite a bit of film and television myself. So, it blends my two areas of specialty quite well, which has been really a blessing. So, as far as artistic experience, I am trying to teach two sets of skill sets at the same time, both how we create a large-scale musical. I was able to pull in, largely due to the pandemic, I was able to pull in some incredible guest artists. David Brady is music director, who is the former music supervisor for Holland America and Carnival Cruise Lines, as our MD, our music director. I've got Ryan Kappelman as our choreographer, who frequently choreographs for Skylight Music Theater. And so these are incredible collaborators for them to learn the traditional skills of musical theater production, while I'm additionally coaching acting for the camera at the same time. So it is a very, trying to keep my goal as the person who's actively creating the musical theater concentration at UW Parkside, which launches this fall. I'm actively recruiting my first class as we speak. You know, I'm attempting to teach those pedagogical skills of how do we make musical theater? What do we expect? What are our processes? While teaching another viable skill set that can help these students gain employment post-grad, which I think is both viable and necessary for them to be diversely trained as they enter the world of work. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with Rachel Swartz, who is coordinator of musical theater at the University of Wisconsin Parkside and the director of their production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, a production which is being performed in a special matinee a little later this morning and shared with the general public tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday. And we'll talk in just a little bit about how anybody interested in seeing and hearing this production can experience it for themselves. Maybe you could say a word about this wonderful show. I've touched on its origins as a made-for-television musical from the mid-1950s, but it has certainly undergone some reiterations and different arrangements over the years. Maybe sketch that history for our listeners a little bit and explain which Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella you're going to be presenting this weekend.
Absolutely. So as you said, there have been a multitude of iterations of Rodgers and Hammerstein's just luscious score. That is one of the things that immediately spoke to me when I was tasked with directing the show, is just how incredibly rich and beautiful it is, and how much it retains, you know, to me, some of those 1950s era, 40s through 60s, I should say, era films that really have those dance-heavy scores, and you know, starred so many of our favorite dancers. It has that feel in so many places to me. However, you know, it then saw its 1990s reiteration, starring Whitney Houston and Brandy, which I think is largely to play with the 2013 Broadway, the original Broadway production, which was 2013. I think that 1997 was largely inspirational into that project. Douglas Carter Bean rewrote the book of Cinderella to give it a hyper-contemporary update. Things that I really like about this particular story is how much self-identity and motivation each of these characters have. Cinderella is a very strong, independent, and spunky character in the 2013. Her autonomy is wonderful and brilliant, and our student Samantha Filer is has dug deep and had a wonderful time exploring just who Ella is. This version it introduces a handful of new characters as well as removed some characters. There is no longer a king and queen, for example, which were incredible in the 97 film with Brandy as Cinderella that many of us knew and loved. Instead, Topher, Prince Topher, the Prince Charming as we may know him, is ruling the kingdom with an advisor who may not have his best interests at heart, nor the best interests of the people. And throughout the course of the story, he becomes more aware of who he wishes to be as a leader. He's enabled by Cinderella. It's just beautiful and tells a great story for both young people as well as those that that may be interested in hearing that rich music that we know and love. I think that this show did a fantastic job in the 2013 update of, while updating, not trying to make it so incredibly timely, retaining the timeless elements that we really know and love. There's still, you know, carriages and pumpkins and glass slippers and all of those things to be expected. And there's some really fantastic, I've had incredible support from our technical faculty as well as student designers for this piece to make it something really magical. And again, that's just further added to by the element of film. But yeah, I think that this was really something done to give this piece a lovely update while not making it so locked in one place. And I really hope that this is the addition that that endures, as it were. It's really something special.
So is this the production in which there's somebody who's kind of calling on the people of the kingdom about their poor living conditions and so on?
Yes.
I remember when I saw this on Broadway, one of the things that struck me was that this did not feel nearly so much like a show meant for kids, for little kids. It gave it kind of a sturdier spine, dramatically speaking. That is, a lot of that element added into it is not necessarily going to speak to little kids the way the heart of the fairy tale does. But on the other hand, the vast majority of people in the audience are going to be adults. And it probably makes sense to be open to this possibility of making this show appeal to maybe to more of a mature audience. Do you think that's fair to say?
I think that's absolutely fair to say. And, you know, it's not a show that then becomes not suitable for young people in the audience. We're still doing fantastical things like turning mice into horses, and you know, there are lots of, you know, the fairy tale creature characters that that appeal to that younger sort. But that that element of calling upon people to better their lives, and as I said, giving so much autonomy, particularly to the women in the show, does open it up like you said, the piece has a bit more spine. I you know, my students were impressed how much teeth, you know, that they could put behind each of these characters, how much there was to grasp into and grasp upon and build from, and how three-dimensional Douglas Carter Bean ensured each of these characters became. Even shifting the placement of one of the songs, not to give any spoilers, as we all know, Cinderella and Prince Charming end up end up happily ever after in the end. That one is not new. I don't believe to any of us. However, placing the song 10 minutes ago after something truly brilliant and moving happens, as opposed to when Prince Charming and Cinderella first see each other, that it doesn't become love at first sight, but instead love that is earned through respect, through admiration, that makes it something really lovely, and something that I think would really appeal to a greater audience, wider than simply our, or perhaps our Disney set, if you will.
When you look at this score, are there particular moments in it that you especially love? That is, certain songs that you think are especially fine and show Rodgers and Hammerstein at their very best?
Oh, absolutely. I am just beyond moved at the Waltz for a Ball. All in all, the ball sequence is roughly 14 minutes in length, and is danced almost entirely throughout. And it includes some of the more classic numbers from the show that we know and recognize. As I mentioned 10 minutes ago, with Do I Love You Because You're Beautiful, or Are You Beautiful Because I Love You, happening later in the act. But the richness of the waltz moment, and hearing the original Broadway pit had, I think, 26 players in it. And you get to hear all of that. Unfortunately, due to COVID restrictions, we were unable to have a live orchestra as we were initially slated. So we worked with Musical Theater International's subset MT Pitt, and have full orchestrations for the piece. They're just simply tracked. But we still get to hear every one of those 26 orchestra instruments individually building throughout, and it is just something spectacular to behold. But additionally, there's the light and comic moments that almost feel more akin to Mel Brooks and Men in Tights than they do Rodgers and Hammerstein, despite being straight from Rodgers and Hammerstein themselves. I think of the stepsisters' lament and our moments with our male ensemble that just are delightfully quirky and funny. So I think that we get both the set of those deeply rich poetic orchestrations, you know, thinking of Oscar Hammerstein as being, you know, the person who inspired Stephen Sondheim to create, and you hear that lineage coming through in the music where the richness of scores has carried through the musical theater tradition through today. In those moments versus their quirky comedy and their delightful carefree nature that pops out in other moments. I think that the combination of those two things to me just make Rodgers and Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hammerstein. You know, Oklahoma's got to have both, you know, South Pacific has to have both. The moments that make us laugh so that way we feel open and welcome and content, and the moments that make us pause and think and get into our heart. I think it's the combination thereof that is just the trademark to me that brings me so much joy in their work.
Very well put. We just have a minute or so left. Will your singers be masked? And if they are going to be masked, what kind of a challenge is that for them expressively and interpretively to tell the story?
Absolutely. So yes, our singers are masked. We are at the point where nearly our full cast has fortunately been vaccinated, so we are truly creating in a safe space. That being said, masking was still priority to me. We're working with so throughout this year, I've done quite a bit of extensive research. I'm additionally on the musical theater faculty for Interlochen Center for the Arts in Michigan, and I've been speaking to my colleagues and music directors and theatrical directors and professors throughout the country all year long about what are the best masks in order to create in. We had started in the Broadway Relief Project Singers Masks, which you won't see on stage, but they largely look like a duck bill, but are very far away from the mouths of the singers and create space for them to you know, open their mouths fully and not have fabric on their lips in order to prevent articulation. But what we found is those masks were boomeranging sound as it reverberated in the mask back into their ears. And then they were having a difficult time hearing literally anyone but themselves, which created issues for blend as well as tracking. So as I continued to research and talk, colleagues and I throughout the country started to come to the conclusion that the KN95s that we can order from Amazon.com are some of the best options for singing, as they stay far away from the mouth. There's plenty of space to fully open the jaw and create the tall vowels that are kind of trademark to Golden Age musical theater singing. But additionally, they come in fun colors, so they've been integrated into the costume design. There is a line in our text, and I don't know how we've gotten so lucky. We had chosen the season prior to the onset of the global pandemic, and three of our five shows directly reference that characters will be masked in them. We started the season with Romeo and Juliet, for goodness sakes. So there is there's a line before the ball scene discussing that the prince will be masked, and that's how the kingdom doesn't know that it's the prince. So it's actually textually supported, ironically, which was a wonderful happy happenstance. So there's lines pre-written into Douglas Carter Beane's book that state the character Gabrielle shall be wearing a pink mask, the prince shall be wearing a white mask, and so on and so forth, in order to, as two of the characters try to, for who he shall marry and become queen and all of that wonderful nonsense that that creates the comedy elements of the script. Because of using those particular masks and mics, there are no audio issues. All of our singers, all of our speakers are individually mic'd. We have someone live mixing the show. So I'm not having any intelligibility issues, nor are the singers having any issues with singing, though it was admittedly more trial and error than I care to admit as to which what product would help that to happen. And somehow we discovered that it's the one that is the least expensive and disposable and readily acquirable, which is never the solution that comes to light, is it? But in this one happenstance, it happened to be, and thankfully the masks are textually supported, so that way it doesn't detract from the storytelling whatsoever.
Very good. So how do people see Cinderella this weekend?
Absolutely. So if they search UW Parkside Cinderella, that should take them to our page for the Rita Talent Pickens Center. And on the Rita Talent Pickens Center's website, there is a link to request a ticket. These tickets are free. All they have to do is choose their showtime. Those showtimes, we had a Friday matinee at 10 a.m. for school students around the country. We had, last I checked, right around 600 students registered to watch. But additionally, we have a show tonight at 7 p.m., one Saturday at 7 p.m., and one Sunday at 2 p.m. All they have to do is select their time, and they'll receive a special link for them to view the show. Those can be watched on computers, or if they have the technology to cast that onto television, we're able to do that as well. And then they can enjoy from the comfort of their own home.
Very good. Parkside's website is uwp.edu. And again, Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella is being performed this weekend. And the director of the production, Rachel Swartz. Rachel Swartz, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you and your cast and crew for Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella.
Thank you, Greg. It was lovely to meet you.